Lows tonight will range from around zero in northwestern Iowa to near 30 degrees in southern Indiana. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, cloudy with scattered flurries. The temperature will hold near steady in the low to mid 30s. The wind from the west at 25 to 30 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. A windy afternoon in store. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 22. The wind will be out of the west from 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny. Look for a high of 35 with a wind out of the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 20s. The wind will be light and from the northeast. Wednesday, mostly cloudy. We'll see a high in the upper 30s. The wind light and out of the east. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain or snow. Look for a low in the low 30s. Thursday and Thursday night, partly cloudy with a high Thursday in the low 40s and the low Thursday night in the upper 20s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana, mainly in the 30s, most locations reporting a cloudy sky. At Rockford, it was 33. O'Hare reported light snow and 35 degrees. Peoria, 33, and Mattoon, it was 35. Carbondale had a sunny sky and 47 degrees. 37 at South Bend, 36 at Lafayette. In Indianapolis, it was 39 degrees at the top of the hour, and Terre Haute reported in with 38 degrees. Willard Airport reported a cloudy sky at the top of the hour, 34 degrees, the dew point 30, the relative humidity 85%, the wind out of the west at 24 miles per hour with gusts to 32, giving us a wind chill of 21, and the barometer read 29.70, and it was rising. And at 12:39, 34 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. Morning Edition today began a series on depression. This first report is from Alix Spiegel, who looks at an idea about what causes depression, a notion introduced years ago that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain.
When I was 17 years old, I got so depressed that what felt like an enormous black hole appeared in my chest. Everywhere I went, the black hole went too. So to address this black hole problem, my parents eventually took me to a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She did an evaluation and then told me this story. "The problem with you," she explained, "is that you have a chemical imbalance. It's biological, just like diabetes, but it's in your brain. This chemical in your brain called serotonin is too low. There's not enough of it. And that's what's causing the chemical imbalance. We need to give you medication to correct that." Then she handed my mother a prescription for Prozac. Now, that was the late 80s, but this story about a chemical imbalance brought on by low serotonin has remained popular. For the last 20 years, it's been told all kinds of places.
You know when you feel the weight of sadness.
In this 2004 commercial for Zoloft, a drug similar to Prozac, an unhappy-looking cartoon circle bumps along, frowning and sighing frequently. Apparently, life as a cartoon circle is not what it used to be. Why?
Depression may be related to an imbalance of natural chemicals between nerve cells in the brain. Prescription Zoloft works to correct this imbalance.
In 2012, you can find that basic message repeated on the popular website Ways and How, a how-to website filled with colorful videos, which includes this explanation in one of its tutorials on how to combat mental disorders.
Studies have shown that low levels of serotonin can cause many problems such as depression and anxiety. If not addressed properly, these effects can be dangerous.
And it's not just websites or drug commercials. This idea that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain brought on by a deficit of serotonin is repeated in news accounts and in doctors' offices. It is a very sturdy little narrative. But for many scientists who research depression, this explanation no longer satisfies. Here's Dr. Joseph Coyle, a professor of neuroscience at Harvard Medical School, who's also the editor of psychiatry's most prestigious journal, the General Archives of Psychiatry.
Chemical imbalance is sort of last century thinking. It's much more complicated than that, and it's not the way we talk about it. It's really an outmoded way of thinking.
While serotonin clearly plays a role in depression, Coyle says, low serotonin is probably not the cause of depression. Scientific thinking, he says, has shifted. Still, the story remains.
I'm not sure I know of any sort of story that has supplanted it.
This is Dr. Alan Frazier, chair of the Department of Pharmacology at the University of Texas Health Science Center in San Antonio. Frazier researches how antidepressant medications work, and I asked him to give me a history of the serotonin story because I wanted to understand its staying power. Frazier says the first time anyone used a pill to treat depression was in the 50s, when a psychiatrist in Switzerland gave a newly developed drug to 10 patients who had been paralyzed by depression for years, and over 3 weeks observed a distinct change in their behavior.
There was this lightening of their mood. They became more energized. They became more interested in things around them. They weren't as tearful, etc.
That was the birth of the very first antidepressants. And with that birth came a question.
How are they working to make people better?
Now, researchers had some ideas, but it wasn't until the 60s that a real narrative began to take shape. That was when researchers discovered the cause of Parkinson's disease. It turned out that Parkinson's, a brain disorder, was caused by a deficiency in this chemical in the brain called dopamine. So it became easy to think, well, maybe the same thing is happening with depression.
It became easy to speculate that perhaps depression was due to a deficiency.
The question, of course, was what chemical was too low? Which was it? For decades, researchers argued this question. Then, Frazier says, something happened. You know where we're going with this inspirational music, right? Prozac.
Talk to your doctor today or visit Prozac.com. Welcome back.
Prozac just blew everything else out of the water.
Almost as soon as it was introduced in 1987, the antidepressant Prozac was a blockbuster. It's a drug that targets serotonin, and according to Frazier, Prozac changed the public's relationship to antidepressants. Every antidepressant before Prozac had serious side effects, but Prozac was easy to take.
It doesn't cause people to get dry mouth, to be incontinent, to possibly fall down because of hypotension.
And because it had so few side effects, Prozac became wildly popular. And remember, it worked on just one chemical in the brain.
It worked on serotonin.
And according to Frazier, it is because of the popularity of Prozac that the low serotonin story really came to dominate our thinking about depression, even though, Frazier argues, the scientific evidence doesn't back that up.
I don't think there's any convincing body of data that anybody has ever found that depression is associated to a significant extent with a loss of serotonin.
Pedro Delgado from the University of Texas is another researcher who makes this argument. In the 80s, he did a study that showed that if you take a normal person and deplete them of serotonin, they will not become depressed.
That was the first really strong evidence which suggested that in human beings, low serotonin wasn't causing depression.
Joseph Coyle, the editor of the General Archives of Psychiatry, who you heard from earlier, is less dismissive of the evidence on serotonin. His take is that while low serotonin probably doesn't cause depression, some abnormality in the serotonin system clearly plays a role. But he says most researchers have moved on. They're looking at more fundamental issues, like identifying the genes which might put people at risk for developing depression.
What's being looked at is processes that are much more fundamental than simply thinking about serotonin levels. We need to move beyond serotonin, and I think the field is.
So why do many people still talk about low serotonin causing depression? Why does this story stick? Alan Frazier says that that way of framing the problem has allowed patients to feel better about taking a drug.
Feel better about themselves if there was this biological reason for them being depressed, some deficiency, and the drug was correcting it. They had a chemical imbalance, and the drug was correcting that imbalance.
In fact, he feels the story enabled many people to come out of the closet about being depressed, and still does.
It's like, yeah, I have depression, but I have a chemical imbalance, and you have hypothyroidism, and you have a chemical imbalance, and my chemical imbalance just happens to affect my brain.
Still, there's no question that the story also has downsides. Though everyone agrees that depression is caused by biology, at least in part, describing the problem in exclusively biological terms convinced many people that antidepressants were the only answer when other therapies, like talk therapy, can work just as well. But Pedro Delgado agrees with Frazier that the story has benefits. Delgado points out that years of research have demonstrated that uncertainty itself can be harmful to people, which is why he says clear, simple explanations are so very important.
When you feel that you understand it, a lot of the stress levels dramatically are reduced. So stress hormones and a lot of biological factors change.
And the real story is complicated, and in a way, not all that reassuring. Researchers don't know what causes depression. They're making progress, but they really don't know. That's the real story. It's not a blockbuster. Elise Spiegel, NPR News.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. The fraud trial of Texas financier R. Allen Stanford was scheduled to begin today in Houston. In the midst of the financial crisis, Stanford was charged with running a $7 billion Ponzi scheme. He is alleged to have bilked thousands of investors in the U.S. and Latin America. Andrew Schneider of member station KUHF has more.
Stanford's trial has been delayed repeatedly, in part because he's fired his legal teams multiple times. The judge ultimately froze Stanford's assets and ordered him to stick with the attorneys he has now. Adam Gershowitz of the University of Houston Law Center says those delays could now work against Stanford.
In these kinds of white-collar cases where you've got very wealthy defendants, oftentimes you've got a defense team that's in the position to outmatch the government and make it really tough for them. Here you're in a different boat.
But the amount of money involved and the complexity of Stanford's offshore dealings raise the bar for the government. Jeffrey Korn is a professor at South Texas College of Law.
The challenge of the prosecutor in a case like this is to demystify it and boil it down to its bare elements, which is you lied to get people to give you money, and then you used that money to lie to the people who had already given you money that that was their profit, the classic pyramid scheme.
And Korn says not to mention siphoning huge amounts off for personal gain. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Tuesday night, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Block. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tuesday evening at 8 on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 23rd of January, 2012. It's the birthday of the French writer Stendhal, born in Grenoble, France, 1783, a psychological novelist more interested in his characters' inner lives than in their surroundings. He graduated from public school in his little town, went to Paris, got a job with Napoleon's war ministry, worked his way up, lived all over Europe, fell in love with women along the way. In Milan, in his late teens, he fell in love with Angela Pietragrua, 23-year-old woman who later became the character of Gina Pietranera in The Charterhouse of Parma, his novel. He fell in love with Matilda Viscontini-Dembowski, the wife of a Polish general, who was smart, she was beautiful, she was unattainable. Stendhal followed her across Italy, trying to disguise himself in green glasses, loitering around the park where she walked, getting himself invited to the same parties she would be at. She let him come sit in her parlor and talk to her, but only once every 2 weeks, which nearly drove him crazy. In his book entitled On Love, he described the seven stages of falling in love, from admiration to pleasure to doubt to what he calls crystallization. He wrote, "Half, indeed, the most beautiful half of life, is hidden from one who has not loved passionately." It's the birthday of the poet Derek Walcott, born on St. Lucia in the Caribbean in 1930, grew up reading Wordsworth, John Milton, Andrew Marvel, got a scholarship to study in Jamaica, then to study theater in the United States, then went back home and founded the Trinidad Theater Workshop. Taught at Boston University, became friends with Robert Lowell, and in 1990 published his epic poem Omeros, a retelling of Homer's Odyssey set on St. Lucia. Derek Walcott, who said, "I come from a place that likes grandeur. It likes large gestures. It is not inhibited by flourish. It is a society of physical performance. It is a society of style. I grew up in a place in which if you learned poetry, you shouted it out. Boys would scream it out and perform it and flourish it. If you wanted to approximate that thunder or that power of speech, it couldn't be done by a little modest voice in which you muttered something to someone else. I come out of that society of the huge gesture, and literature is like that." Here's a poem for today by Charles Bukowski entitled "The Click of Miracle." At the quarter horse meet at Hollywood Park around 5 p.m., if you are sitting at ground level in the pavilion, the track